Okay, welcome again. The next talk is Deep Neural Network Regression at Scale in MLLib by Jeremy Nixon.
Thanks very much. Hi and welcome. Great to be in Spain. My name is Jeremy. I am lucky to have been able to work on top of sort of Zhang Rimeng and Alex Ulanov's original sort of artificial neural network foundational code in Spark. I work at the Spark Technology Center on MLLib, and so this talk is about a new and fairly exciting algorithm addition to MLLib. We can now use deep neural nets for regression, and it's on a roadmap that I think is very exciting and that you'll be interested in. First, to give a little structure to the talk, I'm going to open with sort of an introduction and about me and motivate the problem, both of sort of use cases of nonlinear regression algorithms, but also comparing deep neural nets with algorithms that currently exist in MLLib, so that from the perspective of a data scientist, you'll understand sort of in which cases should I apply a network as opposed to a gradient booster or a forest, or as opposed to a linear model, and what sort of limitations do those algorithms have that this one includes, and how do I sort of include it in ensembles, figure out the sort of trade-offs that are inherent. From the perspective of a machine learning engineer, what decisions go into the process of designing and writing such an algorithm, from sort of the computation of gradients to this sort of parallel optimization that's necessary at an engineering level. And also from a researcher's perspective, how do we think about these algorithms somewhat creatively? How do we decide what experiments are worth running and have a model for the system so that we can predict how it's going to act in important cases? So that'll sort of be the motivation. I'm going to frame deep learning and then move into the model itself. That is, at a low level, how do we actually compute the transformations that lead to an intermediate feature representation that's sort of very rich and valuable, as well as predictions that are extremely capable. There's going to be coverage of properties that is of the model, which will come out of a comparison, and applications, that is, to computer vision, to finance, to sort of physics, to basically estimation of costs. There are a number of domains where researchers have applied this algorithm many times, and so I'll sort of walk you through those applications, and you'll get a sense for what type of data this algorithm performs extremely well on. There's an optimization portion of the talk, so we'll talk about how are we actually computing these gradients in parallel, how are we updating it, how do the masters perform work, how do they communicate the gradients to one another, and then we'll talk about the roadmap, so sort of future work, how are we going to try to enable state-of-the-art performance on important problems in Apache Spark.
Yeah. Oh, it goes underneath. I see.
So about me, just a sort of very short. I'm a machine learning engineer at the Spark Technology Center, a contributor to MLLib, and I'm dedicated to scalable deep learning. Before I worked at the Spark Technology Center, I was studying applied mathematics to computer science and economics at Harvard. So let's open with sort of establishing foundations. I'm sure that most of you are familiar with machine learning, but the scope of applications for regression is fairly large. So in general, what you're going to take is some data and predict a continuous valued output that is some number between negative infinity and positive infinity. And this distinguishes it from classification. In classification, you're trying to predict class 1 or class 2, class 3, et cetera. In this case, we have a number that spans a range. And in general, that number will sort of get larger when one of our features that predicts that number gets larger or smaller. And so there's more structure to be learned from that data. We'll sort of have this continuous range instead of values that are discrete. It's been applied to many important domains, including sort of tracking location and images. So the sort of classic deep learning use case is you have a set of images over time, and there's some trajectory that is based on the location of some object in that image over time. And so you can use a regression algorithm to figure out, sort of localize that that location and find that trajectory. If you want to predict the price of a house and their interactions and the features that you're using, it's going to be valuable to use this model to figure out sort of what is the optimal price based on the square footage or the list price of this house, that sort of thing. If you want to predict the value of a customer over the course of their lifetime, you sort of have a website, you have a little bit of data about this person, and you want to figure out how long are they likely to stay, that sort of thing. There are many, many other applications that could go on for ages. The structure is extremely general. So just to get a sense of the audience, who here's trained a linear regression model, sort of a basic machine learning model? Okay, cool. Great, it's about half of you guys. So those of you who just raised your hands understand that there are many fundamental limitations to a model like that. This is an image of a classic data set that you can fit very well with a linear model, like linear regression. The relationship between the x-axis and the y-axis, at least in the data, is cleanly linear, and you can tell that it doesn't have any curves or shapes that would make it difficult. There's no sort of interaction between variables that would make it hard to model this. It has that major downside, but also it sort of forces the data scientist to do manual feature engineering. So because you can't learn that linear structure automatically, if you want to encode it, you have to actually look at your features and figure out which of these features are likely to interact with one another, or is this particular feature that I'm looking at impacting the output more than linearly? So if it's sort of quadratic in a feature, or if it's exponential in a feature, you have to encode that yourself. That also makes it very difficult for a data scientist to deal with high dimensional data. So take a simple use case like you want to process an image. Well, if you have a very coarse image, you know, something that's 28 by 28 as an example, take sort of MNIST as an example. That means that there are going to be 784 pixels. And so in a 784 dimensional feature space, a data scientist who comes to that data set is not going to be capable of looking at the interactions between all of those features. Even with fairly small feature sets, as soon as you apply a set of transformations to them, they usually become very high dimensional quite quickly. And so not only is it sort of time consuming for the data scientist who wants to build a strong model to actually encode these features, he'll actually fail to find many very important features. And we'll see how a network can learn representations that would be almost impossible for a human to learn manually. MLlib also gives you access to decision tree-based algorithms, which is a simple visualization of a decision tree. It's foundational to a number of ensemble methods, so random forests and gradient boosting machines, which do get very good performance, are also in MLlib. The great thing that they overcome is that they are capable of automatically finding nonlinear structure in data. And so this makes it sort of the out-of-the-box tool that many data scientists go to. It does, however, have a few fairly fundamental limitations. The decision tree can't actually generalize non-locally. So if you have a data point that's outside of the range, it's in a space that you've never seen before for whatever reason, the best that the decision tree or forest or booster will be able to do is predict the closest value. It's not going to be able to sort of see the structure of the relationships and make sort of bold assumptions and make a prediction that it's never been able to make before. There is also this strong restriction so that you can model nonlinear structure, but you are only able to model it with cut points. So it's this huge amount of information. You have this changing set of variables over time, but you can't actually model that directly. You just sort of, wherever you happen to have a data point, we'll assume that everything around that data point is close to where you've modeled it. And so these are a few important downsides that we can actually alleviate. That algorithmic solution is with a multi-layered perceptron for regression, or a deep neural network for regression. Here's an example of the API. There is a basic like layers API, which has you sort of specify the layers. So the first value in this layers call is the number of features that you actually have. And after that, you specify the depth of the network and the width of the network. The depth is just a function of the number of hidden layers that you choose to give it. In this case, we've chosen to give it 5 layers. All of them have width 100. The final output is, in general, going to be 1 for a regression algorithm. This just means that we're just trying to predict one continuous value. If we wanted to predict 2 continuous values or more, that value would be larger. So it's fairly simple to specify. You simply have a set of layers, and then you call, as you would with any other algorithm in MLlib, new multi-layer perceptron regressor. You set the layers, and you set your solver. In this case, we're using LBFGS. We can also use gradient descent or stochastic gradient descent. So I'm going to motivate this content at a very high level and then go into sort of low-level details on how this algorithm works. There have been a number of successes of deep learning, and a lot of them come out of different layer types. So we have dense layer types in Spark currently. We're working and have an implementation that we're improving on of convolutional layer types. And those algorithms are important because they're state-of-the-art in problems that are extremely valuable and that have been sort of core to AI for a long time. Object localization is a task that this algorithm will help a lot with. There is in localization networks, usually a few dense networks at the end, and then this linear layer on top, which this includes. We have sort of object recognition with the convolutional neural net, so the sort of self-driving car or camera that's sort of automatically doing maintenance checks is going to be able to do object recognition much more powerfully than a support vector machine or a random forest or any other algorithm that we've seen thus far. And the performance is to the point where we can compete with humans on data sets like ImageNet. There are also a number of recurrent neural net tasks that were state-of-the-art in that are extremely important. So in order to justify, there are a number of ways that researchers tend to frame deep learning. Automated feature engineering is sort of classic framing. You want to learn your features instead of having to encode them manually. The computer vision community found this out for sort of 2012 with Krizhevsky's sort of convolutional neural net that performed extraordinarily well and hasn't really looked back. Most people are learning their features at this point. In other domains that are sort of farther away from perception, it can be valuable when you need to basically take a high-dimensional space and find features that matter. The sort of non-local generalization ability of the algorithm gives you the ability to find internal structure and basically if there's sort of limited data but an extraordinarily high-dimensional space, you want to be able to try to model that extremely high-dimensional space by using depth. And that depth basically says, with layers of feature transformations, we're going to look at an exponential number of possible features. And instead of trying to predict what features are going to be powerful, we're going to have that network learn at each level what set of feature transformations are most viable by using the gradients. Basically, the output from the neural network will be compared to the optimal output, and we're going to figure out how should we modify features at every single layer. I'll go into a little bit more detail on the impact of depth later. We have manifold learning, sort of exponential structure. There are many ways to frame deep learning that are extraordinarily valuable, and so at a high level, this is justification for what we're doing. We're going to talk a little bit about properties of the model. So the first is we are going to use sort of linear algebra, few transformations to actually get the computations that I'm describing. So here's a very quick overview of the model. I'm going to define just a few variables very quickly. We have a data set that has been normalized. That's a fairly basic transformation. So you always want to take your data set and basically subtract the mean, divide by the standard deviation, which will put your data in a range that's very close to zero. And the reason for this is otherwise the gradients that you compute are extremely large, and so it'll be hard for the optimizer to basically take appropriately sized steps. So we have some normalized data. We have, in this case, two weight matrices. Those weight matrices in this visualization of the network are these connections between the neurons. So in this case, we have five input nodes that would basically be aligned with five features in your data set. Those features are going to be combined with one another in various ways. And that combination is very simple. It's just a weighted sum. And so you can imagine these are the first five pixels, for example, of an image. So you have pixels 1 through 5, but you also have these weights. And for, say, pixel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if we take this top weight for each one, say that's A, B, C, D, E, we're basically going to multiply the features by the weights and then sum all of them up into a single neuron. And those weights are going to be initialized randomly. So that weighted sum is going to be some combination of every single feature in our data set. We're going to do this repeatedly. So there's going to be a different random initialization on these weights. And for each of these sort of hidden layer neurons, this hidden layer representation, we are going to multiply our input by a set of weights and compute a sum over those weights. So these are all combined representations of the input. That can actually be represented as a matrix multiplication. And so that's what you see here with our data matrix just multiplied by a set of weights. That's a representation of all of these weighted sums. We're going to add a bias. The output that we get at this hidden layer is this very interesting representation of the input data. And we're going to squeeze these, putting them through a nonlinear activation, which is how we pick up the ability to learn nonlinear structure. So it'll dynamically find out how to use that nonlinear transformation to structure its predictions. In this case, I'm using a very simple nonlinear transformation. Basically, when we sum these numbers up, we're going to get numbers that are between negative infinity and infinity for all of the values in the hidden nodes. That depends on what our features happen to be, and it depends on the weights that we used before we summed. There's going to be basically a cutoff here. So I'm going to take all of the numbers that are below zero and push them to zero. This is what's called a ReLU nonlinearity, for those of you familiar with these networks. And there are other nonlinearities we can apply, but this simple thresholding nonlinearity has performed extremely well and gotten state-of-the-art performance in important vision data sets. This process can be repeated. So if we don't want to make our prediction yet, if we want to introduce another layer of transformations, we can just treat this as we treated the input nodes and add arbitrary amounts of depth to the network as well as arbitrary amounts of width. You can see that we can add as many basically weights in our network as we like to create as many hidden loads as we like. And that will be determined by some random, as a random initialization of the weights so that we differentiate those features from one another. When we're ready to actually make a prediction, we're going to take our inputs and just do linear regression on them. Effectively take a weighted sum of the inputs and return that value as the output. So this is how we're going to compute these intermediate representations. And when we optimize this model, basically try to figure out what weights get us the best possible output, we're going to find a representation at these hidden nodes that are an extremely rich sort of feature representation, as well as be able to automatically learn nonlinear structure. You can see that I've included a few like very small code samples. Basically, in Spark and MLlib, our encoding is fairly straightforward. Here we have DGEMM, which is matrix multiplication in BLAS. We're using Breeze as a util, and this is just going to take the data and the weights and multiply them with one another, just like we have the data and the weights here. This is another sort of short code sample. This is, as you can see, the ReLU activation function in Spark, and it's a very simple eval function. If x is greater than zero, we return x, else we return zero. This is from the forward pass of the neural network. So this gives us a few properties that are worth talking about. The ability to automatically learn features from the data is extraordinarily powerful. So this is from a paper by Zeiler and Fergus, and it won ImageNet in 2013. But what's more interesting about it is that they were able to visualize the representation at every single layer. So the nice thing about image data is these visualizations are meaningful to us, and you can imagine with other data sets, visualizing the numbers involved would be much more difficult. But here you can actually see what the network is learning at each layer. And what's very interesting about this is that it's sort of a hierarchical structure where at the bottom layer, you're going to learn features that are very fundamental. So you know that this is an image data set and the input is a number of pixels. Those pixels are going to be combined at layer one into very basic features. Things like the lines that you see are sort of small curves, or just sort of the color of the picture, the color that's in the background. At layer two, you'll get a representation that combines the values that are at layer one. And so in the network, mathematically, you can see how we're taking weighted sums of that input. But here, you can actually visualize how those curves or edges and colors are being combined with one another to provide sort of slightly more complex features. And those shapes turn into parts, and those parts turn into objects. And you can see how at the end of the network, right, it actually has to predict what it's looking at. It combines these into fairly concrete representations of the object that it's trying to predict. These features are actually optimized for the data, which is sort of very different from the features that you get as a data scientist, where you have some prediction about how your change to the feature is going to impact your outcome. And you hope that it works, but usually you're going to do cross-validation to check. These features are learned from gradients, and so they are basically going to take a look at what feature representation is going to best predict my output and auto-construct the feature that is optimal for that use case. There are a few very simple relationships that we learn with linear regression, but very often we'll find non-linear relationships in our data, where a feature is valuable up to some point in its range, but damaging at another point in its range, or interacts with another feature in some interesting way. And the ability to learn nonlinear structure with the activation functions that I just told you about is very valuable for these networks. So after writing this algorithm, I did a quick comparison with other algorithms in MLlib. So MLlib offers a suite of algorithms. In this case, looking at linear regression, basically random forest decision trees and gradient boosters, because these are the regression algorithms that we get access to, as well as this deep learning algorithm. So what you're looking at is a comparison between the true label, that is the actual label for this data set, and the label that's predicted by our algorithm. The black line represents perfect accuracy, where the true label and the predicted label are exactly the same. This is a visual representation of a lot of the points that I've been making thus far. So we can see that the gradient booster, random forest, and decision tree are actually all predicting the exact same value once you reach the end of the range of the data that you've been trained on. That is a little bit difficult to see because they actually overlap with one another. But this is the gradient booster in the random forest. They actually perform quite well up to the point of seeing data points that they haven't seen before, but they're incapable of generalizing outside the range, even though there's a very clear relationship, very clear structure here to be learned. Linear regression is capable of non-local generalization, but that generalization is not going to be non-linear. The relationship that we're looking at here is a very simple one. So our data set has two values in it, x1 and x2, and the value that we're trying to predict is just x1 multiplied by x2. And it's a fairly straightforward relationship, but it happens to be a nonlinear relationship. It looks at the interactions between these two variables. And so linear regression will do a very good job of modeling the relationship, but it's going to try to model it in a linear fashion. And because the true relationship isn't a simple linear one, its performance actually tails off over time. This is an example of training with deep neural network regression, which is able to generalize in a nonlinear fashion from the data. And so it really differentiates itself with respect to the other algorithms that are currently in MLlib. So here are a few of the applications. We've gotten wonderful results in computer vision. So the regression applications there look like object localization, object detection. So sort of where is this pedestrian in the image? Where is this object in the image? You can use it sort of end-to-end to do self-driving steering commands. So NVIDIA has this great paper where they use a regression network and sort of figure out the torque on the car based on the image that's being seen, as well as pressure on the accelerator or pressure on the brakes based on the raw pixels that they're looking at. You can also do human pose regression. So you'll sort of see me dancing up here. You can figure out, you know, where are the hands, where is the face, look at these sort of localized points and try to figure out, you know, is this person happy? Is this person, you know, very depressed? What is their pose and what does it mean? There are a number of applications in finance, so sort of authors of papers have looked at the exchange rates in currencies and realized, here are all of these nonlinear interactions. Let's try to apply a neural net, and it'll outperform other algorithms, even like linear regression, you know, after you spend ages doing finding good feature representations by automatically finding those features, doing stock price prediction, et cetera. This obviously is sort of in finance. You have this problem where you have to figure out, you know, how quickly are other people going to adapt what already exists in the system. But if you are going to try to figure out what is worth looking at, a lot of people use models like this to see, you know, what is a neural network based on features that we think matter for this domain predict will happen. There are really amazing results in the atmospheric sciences where you will have a number of sort of molecules in the atmosphere. You have measurements for those values, and those interact with one another to either produce more of a particular molecule that you think it's important to predict, or you can figure out the concentration of a molecule over time. In infrastructure, but also in business in general, you can do cost estimation fairly well when there are interactions between the values that you care about. And so people have applied these deep learning models to that, as well as in geology and physics, sort of hydrological modeling, et cetera. So I want to cover a few features of deep neural net regression in Spark. There is the ability to automatically scale the output labels. And this is fairly important for this model. So we're trying to predict this continuous value. It could be between negative infinity and positive infinity. But the scale of the value is going to be relevant to our ability to optimize for it. So if we have extremely large and extremely small values, we're going to have to learn like sort of weights at our intermediate layers that are extremely large. And those large numbers lead to problems in the optimizer where the gradients get very, very big. And because they're big, they can't be sort of effective summaries of a step that is likely to be good. They'll sort of overshoot or undershoot the step that it's looking at. And so it's very important to scale those output labels to be in a small range. So there's support in Spark for automatically scaling outputs to be between 0 and 1, so that you have a very sort of concise summary of what direction the algorithm needs to go in. There are a number of great properties of MLlib that we actually maintain in this model. So the pipeline API, if you've used it before, basically lets you construct a set of feature transformations and maintain those over all your models. And so if you have built a model before, you know you'll put your data through some feature transformer like a one-hot encoding, then you maybe put your sort of strings through values that will convert them to numbers. And you want to do this over and over again. So for the training data, for the validation data, and for any test data set that you have to repeat this process. Basically, this falls cleanly into the pipeline API so that you can hook it up to the rest of Spark's pipelines. And that also brings in sort of automatic save load, which is extremely important for a model like this. So it can take a very long time to train extremely large models. When we scale tested this algorithm, it was with 12 million neurons, where there's sort of thousands of neurons at sort of 7 layers of depth. And models like that can take a very long time to train. So it's important that you can sort of save and load that. And this functionality lets you basically save the metadata and all of the weights, so sort of all of those intermediate layer points, and then just load it back into any Spark environment. So if you're using PySpark, if you're using SparkR, if you're using Scala, you can save the model and then have a coworker load it up in a different environment if you wish, but also maintain that over the long term. You can also use the save load functionality to share it with other Spark users in the community. And so there's basically the ability to put this sort of file online. Someone else can download it and load that model into their own environment. The optimizers that we support are gradient descent and LBFGS. So in the roadmap, we want to include sort of adaptive moments and sort of adaptive gradient algorithms. There's much more value currently to using LBFGS than gradient descent, in part because of the model that Spark uses. LBFGS will do a sort of a second order approximation and find a really nice optimal point. We also have tangent ReLU activation functions, which are different types of nonlinearity. So I'm going to talk about optimization for a little bit. We basically compute our errors, which are just differences between the predictions and the real outcome, using this mean squared error. And so any regression algorithm will require something that looks like this. This y hat is just a representation of our output value. And this y test is a representation of the true continuous value that we're trying to learn. And this will be critical for generating the gradients that we use to actually find the weights that are optimal for our model. In this case, we just have the difference between our values squared. And so this will be a positive number that represents the difference between the output that we predicted and the output that we wanted. And we're going to normalize. So usually we're going to be doing stochastic gradient descent. We'll have some batch. So say we take 16 data points, for example. We are going to sort of aggregate. So overall 16 of them, what is the squared error? And then we're going to divide by the number of data points so that we get a good representation of the error in this case. So in the optimizer, we have this parallel implementation of backpropagation, where each worker is going to get its weights from the master node, and it's going to sort of do this in sync with all of the other workers. So they'll sort of wait for the master node to be prepared and then draw all of its weights. Every single worker is going to compute a gradient on its data, and so that data can be distributed across your cluster. And if your worker, say, takes 16 of its data points and computes a gradient, all of that is going to be sent back to the master and aggregated with the gradients of many other workers. And that aggregation is a simple sort of sum over all of the gradients and then divide by the number of gradients that were received. And then your master will update the weights and sort of send weights back out to the worker nodes. And the parallelization of this process brings improvements up to about 20 workers and can be competitive with a GPU instance. So I guess the performance tests we covered in a moment, but below I've sort of given you another few sort of code snippets. This computes the gradient for the intermediate layers. So we have a gradient for the bias and we have a gradient for our actual weights. This is the derivative through the activation function. So in this case, with the rate of activation, if we have a value greater than zero, we return one as a derivative, else we return zero. And so this representation of the gradient is used on all these workers to compute, and then they're sort of sent back to the master to update. This is an implementation of synchronous gradient descent. Ideally, we sort of use asynchronous gradient descent where the master has some set of weights, a worker sort of grabs those weights and computes a gradient and can send it back whenever it's done and doesn't have to wait for other workers to grab it again. It leads to a little bit of noise in the training process, but is actually substantially faster overall. So this is from a set of performance tests that we did. There's basically a CAFE, which is this deep learning library that we sort of used a single GPU instance for. It has GPU support. And this parallel implementation of the multilayer perceptron was competitive with its performance once we got up to about 7 nodes in our compute cluster. And so you can get your cluster basically performance that's equivalent to the GPU. If you want details, that's inside of our benchmark. So you can sort of see exactly, what type of machines were we using, exactly how much did it improve for sort of each number of nodes. That kind of thing. There are advantages to parallelism that diminish with additional nodes because communication starts to take over. So in the case of this network, which had about 12 million nodes overall and about 7 layers of depth, that additional value sort of was gained up to about 20 workers, at which point it tailed off. After sort of hundreds of workers, it'll actually get a little bit worse because the communication overload actually sort of slows it down. But there's a performance benchmark here if you're interested. So finally, I'd like to talk about future work. So there are a number of layer types that it's worth including so that we can actually get extremely good performance on Spark. There's no sort of fundamental reason why we can't. So we have a convolutional and max pooling layer type that's ready and that's being optimized. We have a sort of plan that's being put together for a flexible deep learning API. So the API that I showed you before has you sort of enumerate the number of layers that you want and how many hidden nodes there are going to be in each layer. Ideally, we add support for different types. So you want to plug in your ReLU or Tanch activation. You want to plug in a convolutional layer type versus a dense layer type. On top of the network, you may want to do a softmax for a classification. You want to maybe use sort of different error types in that last layer. And there's a lot of flexible options. So we are looking to integrate a cafe style model where you have a document where you enumerate your layer types with a Keras style model. And that's future work that anyone can get involved in if you're very interested and have some expertise in the space. We are integrating more modern optimizers, so adaptive moments, AdaDelta and Nesterov Momentum, more modern activation functions, sort of key regularization functionality, dropout and weight decay, in this case same as regularization. Batch normalization, sort of to ease the optimization process. We want to sort of keep the statistics similar across every single layer. We have a library called Scalable Deep Learning where we have added tensor support. And that lets you basically take an image that is in a tensor format and use it without having to sort of worry about reshaping it or cutting it up into sort of smaller pieces. And there are a lot of internals that get a lot easier if we have tensors. We can represent every transformation as a tensor. And it's sort of very elegant in that sense. And sort of long-term roadmap, it would be great to add long short-term memory, which has sort of state-of-the-art performance on very important tasks. Here's a sort of large set of references for the talk. Feel free to look in them. They'll be in the slides if you need them. And thank you. Any questions?
Could you relate your work to TensorFlow?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number So Torch, Theano, TensorFlow, and Cafe are sort of the large deep learning libraries. They're dedicated to deep learning. They have substantially more functionality currently, and so if you need lots of functionality, it makes sense to use them. A lot of the roadmap that we have is replicating functionality that already exists there. Personally, I use Theano on a fairly regular basis, which is great. There is this huge advantage to basically being able to have Spark in your environment, have MLlib out of the box, and do these transformations on your data immediately. And if you have sort of multiple environments, or you want to like sort of stay in Java / Scala world, it can make a lot of sense to just use something that's already in MLlib. It'll also integrate with everything that's already in MLlib, so if you have a model that's in MLlib that would sort of benefit from deep learning, it's sort of great to have these tools. There's basically features on this roadmap that exist in TensorFlow, that exist in Theano, and if you want access to those, you can use those tools. But a lot of the time, you're going to be adding another tool to your toolbox. And a lot of the reason we have this roadmap is it would be great for Spark users to have this sort of natively in their environment. Does that make sense? Yeah. We haven't tested time-wise against TensorFlow or Theano's yet. We tested against Cafe, but we think that we should be able to, with async gradient descent, get performance that's comparable to sort of single GPUs pretty quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, on the async gradient descent.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. So people were doing parameter servers on the async gradient descent.
Yeah.
We've kind of got away from it now. We're doing InfiniBand, MPI direct model to model. We're doing it on the GPU, but you're up in CPU land, and no one else is there. Why you're up there? How Spark fits into it?
Yeah. No, that's a great set of questions.
Something very similar to what you did with Cafe. So you've probably seen Cafe and Spark.
Yeah, and there's
very similar to what you're talking about
there. Yeah, also SparkNet and some other tools that exist.
The app stuff was actually MPI and
Oh, with MPI, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So for the optimizer. Parameter serving the async gradient descent would be sort of a feasible first step that would make it like fairly easy for people who already had a cluster up and running to sort of use this in native Spark. The reason we don't go the GPU route is there are a lot of sort of requirements that are unlikely to get into the main Spark project. And so if there's not going to be native support in Spark, then you won't get these tools out of the box immediately. The flexible API that I talk about is going to be generic so that you can basically use a CPU cluster. But if people have a GPU extension, they can use basically the exact same function calls with the GPU and an external library. So I guess a lot of people are going to already have these commodity CPU clusters set up. And if they want to do deep learning on those clusters, it should be sort of easy and out of the box. The async implementation is currently limited by a few details in MLlib. I guess we can talk about MPI and its comparisons. I haven't done a sort of scale test comparison or read the paper, whatever relevant papers, to see how fast it is relatively, or if that would be preferable. And so let's sort of chat offline, and if you want to contribute to the discussion, it's happening on Jira. Yeah, that makes sense. So.
Yeah, just comment on this. Yeah. Having deep learning on Spark only, that's just CPU is much designed in the enterprise, because we often have clusters, which are generic purpose, we have Spark, but we are not going to have GPUs on this. So yeah, it would be great to have, but we need generic purpose infrastructure and libraries, and hence that kind of initiatives are much welcome. One remark about the deep learning, I'd say before we throw out all other algorithms in favor of the deep learning networks, as you were explaining, in islands, they are not doing that well. Deep learning often tends to find features where they are not there. I think if you want to predict, say, divorce rate in the US, deep learning will find that it very closely correlates to butter consumption. And it will actually make you credit predictions based on the butter consumption in the US. Well, the manual engineering for features or like two methods
to
be more successful.
Yeah, I'm absolutely on top of you. We should not throw out all methods approach to machine learning. I think, XGBoost and Forests are going to be state-of-the-art on most sort of tabular data tasks, which are sort of standard, business spreadsheet style tasks. There's a number of papers where basically neural nets happen to achieve best performance on those tasks. And they also tend to do fairly well, at least like sort of if you're going to use linear models, we can learn that representation automatically, but we can also learn somewhat more complex representations. And the non-locality can also be valuable in an ensemble if you have data that's sort of not obviously amenable to deep learning. I entirely agree. We should not.
Deep learning tends to take a lot of time. So say there's any fault happens and the computations are stopped, can I resume training? Would
you
save it someplace, like some checkpoints?
Yeah, we don't have auto checkpointings yet. Though the resiliency of the data has been fairly good. So like when we were doing scale testing, for example, we would only sort of run into like memory errors if we obviously allocated too much space. And so as with sort of all Spark applications, you want to be careful in that respect. But that's definitely something that would be valuable to have, basically like intermediate saves of your model in real time. I agree, that would be great functionality.
There are some other implementations of neural network learning on Spark. So SkyMine comes to mind.
Yeah, DL4J.
Can you make a comparison with those or with that in particular?
So SkyMind has a lot of content that we think is valuable. I guess they came and gave a presentation at the STC and have basically this sort of parameter server with gradient descent in the sort of very similar structure that we're going for. I think that their linear algebra library is quite valuable, and so if anyone has used sort of ND for J for linear algebra, it's part of the conversation on sort of how we should do local linear algebra in Spark. I guess comparison-wise, I haven't scale-tested these models against theirs. It's sort of clear that if we get a convolutional neural net that works well in Spark. It'll be worth sort of seeing sort of which product works best for people. But this is sort of based on sort of artificial neural net foundations that are in Spark and will come out of the box. So I haven't done that comparison explicitly yet, and don't really want to comment on it, but yeah, it's good stuff. Okay. I saw another hand. Okay. All right, that's it. Thanks very much.
I have another question.
Oh, okay, sorry. Wait.
So I saw RNN. Is there any roadmap to include some of the
NLP
wireless
with RNN? Yeah, so the RNN isn't immediately parallelizable, which makes it harder to implement efficiently on Spark. There is something called the QRNN, which is a parallel implementation that gets close to the accuracy performance of RNNs, but it's definitely sort of tail end of the roadmap, would be ideal, but mostly we don't have the developer bandwidth right now, and so there are a number of people who have come to Spark with sort of the intent to create RNNs. I would be sort of very happy to do it after we finish up a like parallel confident implementation. But since it's hard to parallelize and since we're not using GPUs, it's going to be very hard to get an efficient RNN implementation that, you know, would make sense to recommend above going to another service that has like sort of a GPU implementation of it. Does that make sense? Yeah, it's just hard to parallelize. Yeah, and we're in a parallel framework. Yeah, that's all. Yeah. Thanks, guys.